Hi, I'm Robin Batram, and you're listening to Soundcheck.
This podcast is brought to you by Neural Media. Are you an entrepreneur or marketer who needs help making podcasts, video, or animation? Perhaps you don't have time to manage a freelancer or the budget to deal with an agency. Well, Neural Media can help you with simple and affordable content creation, saving you time and money by taking away the pain of producing that content. To learn more, head to neural.com/media. That's neural.com/media. Play around with our pricing or request a callback directly. Listeners to the show receive a special discount by using the promo code UNCOMMON. Welcome to another episode of Uncommon. My name's Jordan Michaelides and I'm your host. In this episode, I have for you Professor Robin Batterham. Robin is a chemical engineer, the former chief scientist of Australia, former chief technologist at Rio Tinto. He's now the Kerno Professor of Engineering at Melbourne Uni, and he's also an officer of the Order of Australia, amongst many other titles. Robin is probably one of the clearest thinkers I've ever met on the podcast. He embodies the mindset of brilliant scientists before him, and particularly my favourite in Richard Feynman, where he shows not only this sort of technical nous, but a clear ability to explain some of the most complex topics in the world in the easiest of ways. This was a brilliant episode. We covered a lot. I think you'd really enjoy our discussions on soil carbon and climate change, regenerative farming, climate policy, energy policy, nuclear energy, getting excited about engineering, and of course, ideas versus execution. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a rating on your podcast app. If you want to follow the promos or upcoming episodes, follow us on Instagram. It's just at @uncommon_podcast. If you want to watch the episode, just search Uncommon Neural on YouTube to watch the videos. Show notes for all previous guests are at neural.com/podcast. That's neural.com/podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Our regulars for coming back and newbies for giving us a shot. I hope you'll enjoy this conversation with Robin Batterham. We're live. We got into it. We're discussing what type of table this is beforehand. I'd be intrigued as to whether it is oak or jarrah.
What we call Tasmanian oak isn't really oak. It's eucalyptus bicosta or eucalyptus regina, commonly called mountain ash. But we give it the fancy name of Tasmanian oak because it's as hard as oak and it's a good wood.
So it's just an easy way of saying this is a different type of eucalyptus, basically.
Correct. Right. Correct.
So is it different to the mainland oak?
Well, there's two varieties that are very close. I'm not expert in this field. There's eucalyptus bicosta, and I can never remember which is which. Two forms of mountain ash, and they both have this crazy habit of the juvenile leaves are nice and round, and the adult leaves are like you expect a eucalyptus to be, you know, long and slender. And you can have a young tree in which half of it's clothed in juvenile and half of it's clothed in the adult leaves.
Wow.
The redeeming feature of them is that they grow like crazy. They compete for sunlight. They will crowd everything out.
Really?
And these trees can grow, you know, pick a number, 5 meters in 3 years or so.
Trees are one of those amazing things. I don't think we all appreciate them very much. You know, like they're just there in our everyday life, but they're pretty amazing organisms, I think.
They are indeed. And if you think about trees, everyone knows, all right, how does water get up to the leaves? And the answer is capillary forces. It's like sticking a straw, a really fine straw, into water, and it's just sucked up by capillary forces. But then how does the sap get down to the roots? Because the roots have got to grow and multiply. That takes energy. Where does the energy come from? It's not sunlight down in the soil, thank you very much. It's polysaccharides and the like transmitted down by a pumping process, a cellular pumping process. And this is really all pretty smart sort of stuff.
Really? So there's a, at a microscopic level, there is a system that is pumping the sap down.
Correct. It doesn't flow down from capillary forces. It's rather thick, and the you would have to have incredibly fine capillaries to be able to pull that stuff down.
Jeez.
So, all good fun, but what goes on in the soil is, to me, even more interesting. I'm charging around at the moment recently talking about soil and saying if we get soil right, we actually mop up an awful lot of emissions.
Yeah, that's one of those things that I had this, I don't know if this is true, but I feel like it's one of those things that just passes through the news, or it's sort of one of those old wives' tales, but apparently, the inner suburbs of Melbourne are really not good for growing food at all, because there's a lot of lead within the soil or something like that, due to the fuel that we used to use. You know, how like unleaded fuel is the common place.
I mean, you can look at the tetraethyl lead that we used to put into petrol to get the octane number up. Mm-hmm. The days of engines that ping are long since gone, unless you drive vintage cars and put the wrong petrol into them.
Yeah.
But it was always cheaper to get the octane number of petrol up by putting in an additive, tetraethyl lead, than it was to carry out bulk chemical reactions on the petroleum products, the naphthas that you were dealing with, and upgrade them, which is what we do now, by the way. So you look at the legacy and say, okay, how many of us might just have been a tad more intelligent if there hadn't been tetraethyl lead in the petrol of our parents' cars and in all the cars running around in the suburbs where we grew up.
Wow.
And it's one of those things you can't really say. As far as I'm concerned, all right, we all end up with a set of abilities. Thank you very much. Most of us manage to get through life using what we've got and not worrying about the fact it could have been better.
Yeah, it's one of those things that it's just a fascinating little story to me that I heard recently. It's just I think back to your point on the soil, and that's what got me thinking about it, is I had a very interesting conversation with someone recently. I was actually going to interview a gentleman. I think he's from around the Canberra region, and he worked with a man that in some way had managed, so he sort of is part of that permaculture movement, and they'd managed to change landscapes dramatically, like landscapes that were completely eroding on land that wasn't really used for farms. It was just, you know, a bit of extra land that had been overused over the decades, and they had started transforming that land in this process, which I can't fully remember. It was either to do with the way that they would move animals over the land, or it was to do with the way that they would plant a type of native plant which would draw more water to that land. It would hold water better.
There's a lot in this. And if you take a global perspective, and there's quite a bit of figures on this, but there's also quite a bit of controversy, then what we call the soil organic carbon, that's the carbon which is not inert carbon like graphite, etc., or diamonds, half your luck to find them in the soil, but is organic compounds, humates and the like. And if you look at this globally, the Green Revolution, which is why we have roughly twice the population on Earth as to what we might have had otherwise without the Green Revolution of intensive agriculture and specialist crops and what have you, in most countries is slowly depleting the soil of its organic carbon.
That's right. Yeah.
And you look at this and say, some estimates are that 2/3 of it's gone, and this is just not sustainable. Now, when you look at farming in Australia, the vast majority of farmers are actually pretty smart people. They actually believe in sustainability, because otherwise they don't have a farm in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, next generation, and so on. So quite clearly, they're driven to sustainability. But this slow creep of soil organic carbon and some of the other constituents is actually something we want to get stuck into. And I think that we can do better than what we're doing at the moment. And in so doing, we end up with longer-term, more sustainable soils, longer-term, more productivity. And the jury's out on how you achieve that. And you actually have a pretty cheap source of negative emissions, a darn sight cheaper than some of the costs associated, for example, of turning the snowy hydro scheme into a giant battery of one sort or another. Let's go tackle carbon. I don't think it's an either or. I'm all for heading in multiple directions if we can afford them. But getting soil carbon right is a really smart way to go.
What do you think? That's interesting. Soil carbon, what amount or what? How much do you think it contributes to the greater issue of climate change, or let's lump erosion into that bracket as well?
So, I mean, this is a subject that's delightfully intertwined. Many things intertwine here. Nature actually runs in an incredibly fine balance. There's about 10 times as much carbon goes into plants and into the soil.
Yep.
And then almost all of it comes back out to the atmosphere, almost 10 times as much as anthropogenic emissions. Mm-hmm. So, you know, let's get the numbers game right. If we're 10 gigatons of anthropogenic emissions, what the plants are doing is 10 times that each year.
And just for those listening, anthropogenic means humans, right?
Yeah, us.
Okay.
This is not farting cows and what have you. That's really not a major part of the equation. That's us. But nature is pretty smart, and it's a finely tuned balance, and it's an evolved system. And when we come in and do things like intensive ploughing and then use of high-dosage nitrogenous fertilizers to get our yields up, we kill off microbes that are in the soil that have evolved to be, if you like, a part of the plant root soil system. And it's quite intriguing. The experiments that have been going for over 170 years in the UK and about 120 years, well, slightly less, in the US, where they have field A and field B. Field A gets off-farm organic inputs, commonly called manure, or can have animals let in on it occasionally. Field B just gets nothing or organic or nitrogenous fertilizer.
Yeah.
The productivity long-term of the fields with manure beats the other fields.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that.
I'm not surprised about that.
And the microbial activity is so much higher. And these are the microbes that break things down in the soil, make them available for the roots, that help minerals get into the plants, and on and on and on it goes. So I'm all for soil carbon and getting it higher, and see it as something farmers ought to be paid not only for the benefit that they're getting in preserving a landscape, and by the way, generating more soil, because deeper-rooted plants actually break down the subsoil and convert it into soil.
Yeah. Okay, so this really reminds me of this topic that is becoming more and more popular, as you said yourself, amongst farmers in Australia, and it's called regenerative farming. And the method that I was talking about was talking about the planting of certain trees, but this... Yeah, we've interviewed someone, her name's Tammy Jonas, and she sort of leads that push here in Victoria, but she brought over a gentleman from the US who sort of really started both the movement but the research that's happening on the east coast of America around this sort of farming. And basically, like you said, they would use, I don't know whether you call it organic material, but fertilizer, which is basically cow dung. And the process was that, let's say they have 10 acres. The cows would go through an acre spot first, and then they'd be led on to the next one. And then behind them would follow a trolley of chickens who would scratch through the dung. So they're moving around the dung for you on the soil. Mm. And then the next movement would come through pigs. And it would go sort of around like that. And they would be moving, I don't know what the measurements are, but let's just call it 10 acres. And that in and of itself would, it would rapidly change how quickly the grass was grown. So they never needed to buy hay or feed or anything like that. Mm. Unless, of course, you're in a very wintry region, but in this case, they weren't.
This is classic regenerative agriculture, and the elements are essentially, first step is that you don't plow. You might occasionally rip with a deep tine to lift soil up a bit and aerate it a bit, but plowing, which is really for weed control, the no plow, the no till, you have to leave your stubble and you have to plant cover crops and so forth, or you will get weed infestations. And indeed, every 5 years ago, you might have to till the ground in a gentle way just for that, or use extensive weedicides, and you're trying to move away from that. Mm. So that's one element of it. So the rotation of crops and using different crops in summer and winter, and when you plant cover crops, not just one crop, but planting perhaps two or three different crops to get the synergies between them, right, and to get the fact that crop A might be inimical to certain insects, and crop B, actually, they'd like to feed on them, but they don't get stuck into feeding on them because crop A is there with its natural...
Yes, totally segregated.
And et cetera. So there's all sorts of parts of that. Then in terms of fertilizer, I don't go along with the notion that says, therefore, you should use no external fertilizer. It depends on the chemistry of the soil, the crops that you're growing, and et cetera. There can be good reason to use modest amounts of fertilizer, and whether they're NPK or urea or whatever, you know, you tailor it to the conditions in the crop. I'm not an expert in this area, I hasten to add, but I've talked to a lot of people who do know what they're doing and can spell the words.
That statement is very refreshing to go on to the next topic I wanted to talk about, because so often when we get into fields of science, I mean, you were the chief scientist of Australia and you're a chemical engineer and you say that, yet I don't hear many other people say that. And maybe that's because you grew up and learnt in the environment, you know, that pushes forward people like Richard Feynman who say, I don't know everything and, you know, tell me. If you're an expert, tell me and I'll learn. And so one of the questions I got from a listener was around energy / climate in Australia, because, you know, just to give some context of your career, you were Chief Scientist of Australia from 1999 to 2005, I believe.
Mm-hmm. 6 years.
Yep. Yeah, 6 years.
All good fun.
Chief Technologist at Rio, and you're also President of Technology and Engineering, President of the Academy. Academy of Technology and Engineering. Needless to say, you're in many lists and now the Kernot Professor. Mm. And I know that during your time as the chief scientist, you back then the role was part-time. So you split your time between that and Rio. And I think during that time, that was when we started to see this sort of politicalization of climate policy or climate discussions. And so there was this whole thing with supporters of renewables who claimed there was a conflict of interest. Anyway, long story short, the role was made full time, and therefore now that there's no conflict supposedly.
Sure. I mean, to just one comment on that. I mean, there was actually a Senate inquiry, which
That's
was
right, yeah.
Very ably chaired, I might add, mm-hmm. By the current Shadow Minister for Science, Mr. Carr, and it found that there was a perceived conflict of interest between the two roles, but that me personally had not had any conflicts of interest or done anything untoward.
Yeah.
but there was certainly a perceived conflict of interest. And the answer is, of course there was. And perhaps if I'd run around saying, oh, by the way, today I'm talking with this hat on, or whatever, it might have quelled a few people's concerns.
Yeah.
But the easy way out of that is just say, oh, you know, for heaven's sake, just make it a full-time role. Then you just can't have perceived conflicts of interest.
And I think, look, to be fair, if you look at the role, it's not all about climate science. It's vastly not about climate science.
And about an awful lot more than that.
Yeah. Well, it's mainly about commercialization and investing in new science, new technology, funding of science, hard science, more than it was ever about that. So that's what I found. I found that interesting, but it just made one of the questions that we were asked is, how do we combat this politicization? I don't know if that's the right term, but this sort of, the left says that the world's ending in 6 years, and the right says that there's no such effect by humans.
There's a lot of very strong language around, and I'm reminded when you're having deep arguments with people that come from quite different sets of assumptions and beliefs and start talking what are essentially beliefs, that you can never settle the argument. So, you know, we have to start by saying you are not going to convince the people who, and I'm not one of them, who are down the end of the spectrum that says climate, you know, it was global cooling quite not too long ago, then it was global warming, and because you can't make up your mind, you call it climate change, and so it goes on and on. You're not going to convince people who just say, look, the Earth's a big system and it'll sort itself out. It has in the past, as compared with those that say, and there are learned scientists, by the way, they're not climatologists, they're people who study the geology and what's happened through in the past, and they're bursting into print saying that not doing a lot more now is a form of terrorism, no different to slitting somebody's throat.
Jeez.
Now, that's...
that's crazy.
When you line up A versus B there, don't even bother to come to some compromise position. And, of course, there are all sorts of shades in between. I adopt a very different position, which says, OK, you know, Mr. Arrhenius and others, we've known about the so-called greenhouse effect. It's responsible for growing an awful lot of our vegetables and flowers, by the way, where we enhance the CO2 in greenhouses to get higher growth rates. You know, we sort of know this stuff. And, of course, as temperature goes up, all the rate processes, the chemistry goes up, so do the water losses, of course.
Yeah.
So this has been around for a long time, and you simply can't say, oh, yeah, but because CO2 is measured in parts per million, this is insignificant, therefore we won't worry about it. And besides, water vapour in the air is umpteen times more. And by the way, when you look at the Chinese, who have been observing sunspots for a couple of thousand years to forward predict the seasonal weather, and it's not a bad correlation that they have over a couple of thousand years, thank you very much. So when you look at all of that lot, I come out on a much different position, and I make two points about it. Firstly, science is not about truth. Never. Science is about utility. You make a hypothesis. Now, we could make a hypothesis that says, if you walk outside here onto the balcony and jump off, when you hit the ground, you will actually not be quite the same person as when you jumped off. Okay, now we can test that. Now, I don't know whether you go first or I go first or neither of us, or we chuck a model off or something and observe it. But that's a hypothesis, and we can test it. And if it's a useful hypothesis, we use it. So Newton, with the apple on the head and all this sort of thing, Newtonian mechanics, we use it to say if a car accelerates at a certain rate and it weighs a certain amount and you put it into a brick wall, we can sort of tell you the momentum transfer and what's likely to happen.
Yeah.
And then Einstein says, yes, but, you know, if you're traveling near the speed of light, things warp a little bit. And now we have yet another generation that says, actually, time just might go backwards in certain circumstances if you're in the vicinity of a black hole and so on. So science is about hypotheses, that are useful. And as soon as they're not useful, or we come up with something better, like Einsteinian relativity, we drop the old one or can only use it in limited cases.
Right.
So that's the first point. It's not about truth. You can't say you're right, I'm right, you're wrong, I'm wrong, or whatever. It's not about black and white. It's about hypotheses, whether they're useful, and what we get out of them as predictions. The only point of having a hypothesis is that you can predict. And I predict if you go out that window and jump down to the ground, you are going to be injured. I don't think we'll test it.
Yeah.
So you now come to something that says the science is fairly clear cut, and it's using the hypotheses that go into things like the Navier-Stokes equation, which is how we model the weather and so on. It's using the greenhouse effect, which is the hypothesis that this amount of CO2 into the air will do, blah, blah, blah. And that's been tested over more than 100 years, I might add. So that side's pretty clear cut. You then come to say, well, so what? What are we going to do about it, apart from having entertaining political debates? I'm not sure who's going to win the next one, but you're bound to have climate policy will come up as part of it. And I just turn around and say, what we ought to be doing is not regarding our current level of activity as terrorism or saying we need nothing, but adopting a no-regrets path that says if we can do things that are a reasonable cost, and remember, 70% of the world's agriculture is subsistence agriculture, just growing enough to live on.
Yeah.
So for us to turn around and say we're going to spend all of our money on renewables actually is not necessarily doing the world as a whole much good. You really do have to think through how, in economic terms, you spread the wealth around and develop people and the like. So I come down to pragmatic things that say, okay, if soil carbon can be worth a fair bit of negative emissions and we actually get other benefits out of it and the costs are more, doing quite a bit more research on what are cheaper methods of measuring soil carbon, for example, what off-farm organic inputs can we use. By the way, lignite, brown coal, is one such that you can build into compost and use in feedlots, etc., to get the ammonia smell down and so on. Let's do things like that. If the cost of batteries via a few breakthroughs comes down a long way, then of course every household should have one. Thank you very much. And so it goes on. Let's do the things that help on emissions and don't put us backwards, and I mean really backwards economically. That's the driver, not is the science right or wrong.
Yeah.
Science is about utility. It's not about being right or wrong.
One big part of that is obviously that element of soil, but the discussion around energy, that is the big topic here. It's probably the second biggest topic here in Australia for the upcoming election, I guess you'd say.
What's the biggest one?
The biggest one would probably be money. Like, they always argue of, you know, like, Labor,
and fiscal responsibility.
All that stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's always the number one argument.
Yeah, hip pocket.
And then maybe it's... It depends on the year, but I think the second biggest topic is definitely energy because prices have gone up. I've been paying a lot of attention to that recently because I've been intrigued by... There's the obvious fact with the batteries, you're so right, in that they can't... They're not very efficient for the price that you pay at the moment in terms of the energy they store and so forth. Like, you can't... From what I've learnt or understood is I can't see about 10 or 20 of them being installed in Victoria anytime soon. And also that the thing that supplies them with the energy that they're charged with is still way too intermittent on a long-term scale, so to speak. Like, I like looking at OpenNEM, which sort of shows you the grid by percentage breakdown, by coal, renewables, hydro, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
And it's got me thinking about things like nuclear. Like, nuclear is never really a discussion that we have. It's sort of just like a taboo topic. Chernobyl happened, there was Fukushima, and now no one wants to touch it. But in terms of the damage that there is and that can be caused, it seems like nuclear is potentially on the lower spectrum. And still guarantees reliable long-term, like 20, when I say long-term, I mean like 20, 30-year type energy supplies.
It's nuclear is an interesting debate, and it's one that's worth having in some depth. There's no doubt that a disaster like Chernobyl, or Fukushima for that matter, disasters like that, you just don't want to have around the place. And equally, the way the current long-term waste is handled, I would argue, is not sustainable.
Right, okay.
The US, under Obama's time, spent an awful lot of money looking at a long-term geological storage for nuclear waste, because there's a fair bit of it in the US the nuclear reactors. Any country that's got nuclear reactors is making long-term waste. And this is 100,000-year type waste. And most people are of the opinion that really what you've got to do is find a suitable geological formation, stick it into it, if you like, roll the stone across the door and come back 100,000 years later.
Yeah.
I'm not making light of it, I might add. And ultimately, the US said, look, it just can't guarantee the seismic activity, the geological stability, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I compare that with Sweden, which is a country which is pretty green and pretty anti-nuclear into the future, I might add, has decided on a long-term geological storage and is in the process of building it.
Really?
You can get these things right, but it's an awful lot of politics. Australia, just for some low-level waste, every hospital has low-level waste in it. Thank you very much. We use radioisotopes in medicine.
Yeah.
I was going to say until they're coming out of our ears, but that's a bad an unfortunate analogy. And what happens to that waste? We actually have to have long-term storage for low-level wastes here in Australia. I look at this overall and say, I'd make a couple of points. Firstly, if the world wanted to, it could get an act together in terms of waste. And it would run something like this. You have to run at least one of the five reprocessing plants, all of which were built to extract plutonium to make nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. That's why we've got them. They weren't built for peaceful purposes, but they're actually what you need to take the waste, pull out one component of the waste, commonly called the minor actinides, doesn't matter what they are, but it's a nice name and it rolls off the tongue. And they're the stuff that takes 100,000 years or so. What's left after you've pulled them out is, you know, perhaps 100 years, perhaps only 50 or 70 years. And quite frankly, we can engineer structures. We don't have to go searching for Precambrian rocks that haven't been tilted, you know, in the last 100 million years, assuming you're not a creationist. And so reprocessing is essential. But here's the catch. If you do reprocessing, that actually allows you to, if there's any plutonium there, to pull it out. So a reprocessing facility would have to be essentially controlled by all countries and very thoroughly supervised. But right. I don't see that as a problem. I mean, for a cede a little bit of land somewhere to the United Nations, Times Square in New York or something like that, build a that's not serious comment. But you could do the reprocessing. And then once you've got these minor actinides out, you put them into a fast nuclear so-called breeder reactor, of which there are two in France, for example, and there are others around the world. And you zap them, and that brings their 100,000 years plus down to sort of 10 to 20.
Right.
Problem solved. So, but it would require that nobody buys uranium, puts it in a reactor and then makes waste, which then just sits in a shed somewhere. Mm. It would require that the commercial side of it was that you lease the uranium and it comes back and it gets reprocessed. You get the reprocessed fuel back, plus a bit of top-up, what have you, and the minor actinides go off to a fast breeder reactor. So the waste problem can be solved. Proliferation can be solved if you control the whole cycle. So there are people, and Bill Gates is one of them, who are putting a fair bit of money in to coming up with intrinsically safe reactors that can't do a Scherbinel. And remember the Fukushima... no, I better not comment.
probably not, but also I think there's been enough documentaries now to show that there were fundamental issues with that plant.
Both Scherbinel and Fukushima. Yeah. What my point is that if the Bill Gates, and he's not the only one, nuclear battery, 100 megawatt type battery, sealed, you know, conceptually think of it like a giant battery with two terminals on it, and you wheel it in and you get your 100 megawatts on demand for 10 to 20 years or whatever time scale, it's not 100. And at the end of the day, the whole thing is carted off and yeah. in comes a new one. So it's just like we put lithium-ion batteries into our devices now, and when they run flat, we take them out, properly dispose of them, please, and put new ones in.
Yeah. So where did you see that Bill Gates discussion? Was that a post that he had written, or had he done a talk of some kind? Around that, because I feel like that's where I started to notice this discussion around nuclear coming back. I feel like he was the one to first start talking about this maybe a year or so ago.
He is putting money in at a fairly significant level. My understanding is that there are Chinese companies who are joining with him in this venture. Mm. I think what's the name of the company that he set up? It's something. It's slipped my mind. But
that's all right. We'll link it.
You'd be able to drag it out.
Yeah.
I mean, in my mind, I'm thinking Yarra Power, but it can't be that. You know, we're too close to the Yarra River. but it's something relatively simple like that.
Okay.
And they've done some years' work now on design. They haven't built anything that I'm aware of, although that could be happening as we speak. And I think that's a great idea, providing any waste from such reactors is treated along the lines that I mentioned. You have got to have the waste reprocessing under control and very tight control.
Mm. How far are we away from fusion, do you think?
I mean, that's a lovely question. The smart-ass response on fusion is that fusion has been 20 years away or 10 years away, you know, pick your number, or 50 years away for the last 50 years, stroke or 20 or 10. And it does appear that way. The subtleties of controlling a plasma at extremely high temperatures and with massive forces. I mean, this is stuff where if you think of a toroidal plasma and you think of stirring a bit of fluid around in a glass and trying to control the ripples on the surface of it, because if one of those ripples just happens to touch something nearby, it'll zap a hole in it. Thank you very much. And people are working on this. The Brits, the British people did an awful lot of work, largely out of their own steam, I might add, on the turbulent structure of plasmas and how you might control it. The EU project, which has got many other countries, not just the EU, I've forgotten the name of the place where it is.
This isn't CERN, is it?
No. It doesn't matter where it is. It's in EU. I had in my mind that it's near the French-German border somewhere. Anyway, it's a massive toroidal reactor to demonstrate that the engineering degree of difficulty is not as high as people think, and costing, of course, many hundreds of millions up in the billion type scale. And I look at that lot and say, you know, I love engineering challenges and so forth. Great if they knock it over. But for now, let's all just sit tight and say, yeah, well, it's another 10 years that it's been 10 years away to demonstrate something which had an engineering degree of difficulty is a little bit more ready than laboratory phenomena. So there's very serious effort going into it.
But not much to show, unfortunately.
But I think it's going to be a while before we see it. This is going to be one of these things where it's quite possible that some alternative techniques, such as a string of lasers all zapping some poor little pellet at the same time and just for a picosecond, etc., then standing back and pulling energy out of the flash from the reaction.
That's right.
Where it's just possible that at a tabletop level, they might crack it as compared with the massive toroidal plasma fields, which is the mainstream.
And so for people listening, that's essentially whacking a whole bunch of atoms together in a circular, like at CERN, in sort of what do they call it?
It's not a ring. It's a when you imagine a toroid,
yeah,
a donut.
It's the inside plasma, of the donut.
It's the plasma is like the skin of the donut, and it's circulating around so that you get the conditions in the center of the thing that are hot enough, like extremely hot, to get the reaction
energy
that you want.
Yeah.
It's not cracking. It's actually fusing together.
Laser one interests me a lot. This whole stuff around fusion is like I feel like it's going to be the thing we need if we're ever going to become like a space going race. It may be the form of energy that we need to allow people to do these extreme things, like going in very far directions to other planets, other solar systems, whatever it may be. It fascinates the hell out of me. Any documentary I can watch on the topic, I always take a look.
I think you've got two sources of propulsion out in space. One of them is take something with you, like a nuclear reactor, and just spew ions out the back, which actually provides a propulsive force. That's been done quite some while ago. The other is one way or another to harvest the solar wind or even solar radiation. But if you're thinking
that's already out there,
and of course the space station, the orbiting space station, had pretty massive solar collectors on it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean there are ways on that. I look at that lot and say, well, you know, I would hope that any serious space exploration that we get into, and people still like having a crack at the moon, of course, let alone Mars and landing a few things on it or circling Venus, is done for the hell of it, so to speak, and the learning that you get out of it, rather than the, oh dear, we've got to leave Earth because we've stuffed it up.
No, well, my mindset is like, I sort of like the Elon Musk approach. It's sort of hedging the downside. If there is ever... the potential for destruction from an asteroid, not of the whole Earth, but of the environment that we live in, because the Earth will be fine. It's just us that'll be in trouble. It's good to sort of check that downside by allowing us to move to other planets, solar systems, etc. That's what intrigues me the most, I think. I mean, growing up on Star Wars, how could I not like that sort of stuff?
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. I never really figured out with the series why it started in the middle and then sometimes worked backwards.
Yeah, I reckon it was just...
A good idea.
This is the original story. Now I've created this whole canon and lore. And
what else can I add to it?
How else can I make money? Oh, I'll do this whole CGI prequel thing.
Exactly.
That is absolutely horrible. But you know what? On Star Wars, I'm very glad that it was bought by Disney, because now we're getting about a Star Wars movie every 2 years or so. So I'm okay with that. People complain, but I'm okay. Now, you seem to have this sort of innate... interest in energy and mining and these sorts of areas, and I was just I was curious as to what was sort of the initial catalyst for you before you even started doing your undergrad. What was the thing that excited you about this area of science?
Well, I've never really been in one area.
Yeah.
And to the exclusion of others. I mean, as a student, a school pupil, I could never make up my mind whether to do music, maths, yes. Or engineering. And being a weedy little guy and not that good at sport, very good at long distance running, at an all-boys school, you had to be able to look after yourself. And my forte, apart from being able to run long distance, my forte was being not unreasonably good, not bad, actually, at maths. So when I was in year 7 or 8, I was tutoring year 12 kids in maths. Whoa. And I regarded most of the maths as so trivial, I really couldn't understand how people couldn't understand it. but I've since learned there's all sorts of good reasons why they can't understand it. And then I had a grandfather who was a professional musician. He was city organist. He was a composer. He was the ABC librarian, etc.
Wow. So that's how the organist bone came in.
And all of that. And, I sat turning pages for him in concerts in the town hall. I can remember it. And I can remember being terrified because you're up quite a long way from the stage, some 4 meters or so, and there's only a thin bar behind you. And there's no way an adult could slip between the bar and the seat and fall off backwards
onto the stage.
But a sort of 10-year-old turning pages for his grandfather, that was sort of in my mind. And I sort of looked at all of this and thought, well, what do I want to do? Music or engineering or maths? And I thought, well, you can always do the music, which I have through my life.
That's right. Are you still the assistant organist at Scott's?
No. I've finally retired from that after 20 years there. I still turn my hand to it every now and then. For example, last week at St. James Old Cathedral, and this coming Sunday, I have a house organ in Parkville, and I have a house organ in our house in Munich as well. How can you have a house without a house organ, for heaven's sake?
That's amazing. The installation on that must have been interesting.
Oh, entertaining. I mean, they're works of art, actually very finely made. But the engineering side won out, but always with a background of maths and in parallel doing the music. Well, I mean, when I finished my PhD and postdoc, and took my first real job, I had to give up all the music side. And the net of that was I actually dropped my yearly earnings by a significant amount by taking up a research scientist position in CSIRO.
So how does that work? So you got paid more for being an organist at that time than doing research of the CSIRO?
Well, if you did 5 funerals on a Wednesday and 5 weddings on a Saturday, that was not a bad sort of income.
Wow. So why do you think engineering won out? Have you always been a sort of practical individual?
Well, my father was an engineer and a brilliant one. While some might dispute it, he essentially developed the type of underwater breathing, self-contained underwater breathing apparatus, the scuba that is used globally these days. Jacques Cousteau and Air Liquide are generally considered the inventors of it. But if you look at who took out patents first in Australia and who then sold it to Air Liquide, it wasn't Jacques Cousteau's invention.
Really?
So,
what was your father's name?
My father's name was Morris Samuel Batterham, and he was in the Navy, but he was an engineer in the automotive industry before that. And he was just so inventive in terms of design, in terms of making things. So, as a kid, I grew up, he had a great workshop.
Can imagine.
churned out all sorts of things. And to this day, you know, I really admire some of the design, let alone the construction, because we weren't rich, far from it. I mean, I was only at the school you went to because I was on a scholarship.
Yeah, same with my brother, got a scholarship. He was brilliant at maths as well.
Yep.
And that allowed me to get a general 25, you know, they give you like a 25% off if you're good
at... siblings, exactly.
Well, siblings, and if you're good at... back then, they'd allow you to do it if you're good at sport, you know, competing at high-level sport and you had above average... Mm. Education or whatever. So I was very lucky to go to Brighton Grammar. Yeah. Just got to Brighton Grammar. Yeah.
Well, likewise, mind you, I earned it on the music side.
Yeah.
Nearly got thrown out on a few occasions, but these things happen.
They threaten you with... I remember my parents used to always threaten me to send me to some school if I was playing around. I remember there's a period where I was in detention 2 weeks in a row, and that was... that was when the threat started happening. few appointments to the headmaster's office. Just on that, do you have any particularly fond memories of Brighton Grammar?
Brighton Grammar was actually a very accommodating school. They taught comparative religion, for example. When I was there, anyway. And I think everyone should learn philosophy, comparative religion, and so forth. I really don't like the idea of steaming through to year 12 and just having, for example, two maths, chemistry, physics, and English because it's compulsory. You're missing out on so much. I'm a great believer in a generalist education, including a bit of philosophy, a bit of religion. You just understand the world so much better, including people.
Yeah.
For a start, it gives you a perspective that says, you're not the only person on the planet, mate.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I know they were very good at that. They didn't have philosophy as a standalone class when I was there, but they offered it as an extra class that you could pick up and replace. Like when I was at Ross River in the middle school, it was sort of like you would replace it with you'd have one session per week. Mm. And it was really good because I learned about like Chinese or Eastern philosophy, Confucian philosophy at the time.
Yep.
To me, which was... And I've always been someone that is intrigued by the history of things and to learn all that stuff, it's like, wow, this exists and I had no idea, you know, and this has been around for thousands of years. So it was a good school. I'm glad I was able to go there. Yeah. Very lucky.
But the principle of an expansive education is a good one. Mm. I think you can carry it too far. I think in some European countries where essentially to end up with a diploma, as they would call it, a graduate degree or even a master's, as we would call it, you end up being 28 to 30 before you actually get out into the workforce.
Yeah.
And you've spent so much time becoming hair engineer diploma or hair architect diploma, blah, 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 that you tend to, in some cases, have a view that you're the expert in an area when with almost no practical experience. And but this massively general education, you know, big tick for that. And you compare that with the Australian system whereby at age 21, you can have graduated in science or engineering and bingo, you're out in the workforce and you're unstoppable.
And
you have got the energy, you've got the ideas and so forth. You've still got elements of being idealistic. before you do the old Churchillian thing of starting to become more conservative, which some people do, etc. Yeah. And I saw this in Germany when there was an Australian team sent over to work with a German team who had a brilliant technology which was capable of quite changing the way we make iron and then on through to steel. And the German men tended to regard themselves as having all the answers. We just need to build the plant and demonstrate that it works. The Australian team would be, let's try this, ding, 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 ding. Oh, that doesn't work, so let's try this. And so it would go on, much to the frustration of both sides. But they sorted themselves out, I might add, and sort of got it right. But it just struck me that the difference between our system and the German system was that it was several years different difference between when you churn out a university graduate. And I think actually somewhere in between is a better system.
Yeah.
A more general year 12, something like the Melbourne model, which I'm very keen on, far more general first degrees,
yeah.
And then do a year or two of learning to spell the words in whatever takes your fancy.
Yeah, and my brother's done, well, he's in probably his last year now at the School of Engineering. So he did his undergrad in maths, but he decided he was going to do his master's in maths and then obviously research. But I think he decided it was just not, the idea of doing research was not for him. And he chose software. So he's now gone down the path of software. But that experience as a generalist in maths is incredibly valuable for someone who's a software engineer now,
yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah.
This brings me to the point around, or the intrigue I had around teams. So I covered your career before. I think before you were the chief scientist and chief technologist at Rio, you had basically worked at the CSIRO and worked your way up to the head of the division focused on minerals. So it seems that over your career, you've been there to lead teams. Lab teams, in the case of the chief scientist, there would be multiple labs. So it just had me thinking about what is sort of the item that stands out the most, the lesson learned, the principle, the first principle, whatever it may be, around how to get teams to work in innovative ways and productive ways. Because, you know, I've read books like Deep Work that talk about how labs are oftentimes the best environment for both communication and work, but you go to an office and then all of a sudden people get bogged down in email and conversation and all that sort of stuff. So I was intrigued by that. What have you learnt in that regards?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's a very broad one, perhaps starting at the back end on the office environments. There's a bit of a reaction now against open offices, which
yeah.
were supposed to engender more collaboration, more interaction. Because what we know is that in the world, in everything that you do, you've really got to think about innovation. You've got to think about how can you do it better. Now, a pragmatic point would be because otherwise some smart person somewhere else in the world is going to learn how to do it better and you're out of a job. You know, it's as simple as that in the long run.
Yeah.
But it's fun actually to be always coming up with something new, seeing how far you can take it, etc. Is the market interested in it? Is it filling a need and so forth? And if it's not, then get on with the next one, etc. It's not your lifelong work to prove that you can make a widget ABC and just because nobody wants it, it's their fault, not yours type of thing. Get on with XYZ. So rounding off on this open office stuff, what we know is, but it's often forgotten that any innovation, and I'll use the word innovation, I don't want to get into calling it entrepreneurial activity and building something new and so forth. Any innovation is path dependent. It depends on your knowledge base and it depends on the knowledge base of the people that you're working with and the environment that you're in. Whoops. I mean, let's just think of that mathematically. If we were building a neural net and so forth, we've got a whole series of inputs, then we've got a whole series of next layer of neurons and so forth. These neurons right down at the output end can only fire off when something comes into them, and stuff can only come into them from what's there already. Plus you chuck in a bias term and so forth. You know, this is how you build neural nets. And what that says is that if you want to come up with a different program to what you've got at the moment, you'll use all of your experience. You'll chat to other people and so forth, and you'll take the thing through further. That involves people-to-people type stuff. It involves looking at what others have done, finding out about it, searching it on the web, or, you know, in the old-fashioned days, going to a library and all that sort of thing, attending conferences and what have you. But you've got to be the one that comes up with the creative spark that says, this is worth a fly. And then as soon as you do that, if you keep it all to yourself, that's actually not a very smart idea. Sharing it around and seeing the reaction to it and then reshaping it and building it and taking it then through, perhaps with other people, but perhaps with an improved idea, is the smart way to go. So you do need the people interaction. But what we find, and there are some very good studies now of people moving who are in, let's say, a business where innovation is the name of the game, moving from having individual offices or small group offices into open plan, is productivity goes down. And the intriguing thing is, and this has been measured by wiring people up for sound, recording their eye movements, recording what they're saying, etc., counting the number of people they interact with, what the conversations are about, and this is all done with the consent, and it's a 3-month scan before they go into open office, then 6 months after they've gone into open office, and so they've had time to settle down, work out their new ways of working, etc., etc., 3-month scan. This is really reliable data, and there's two sets of large studies like this. And what you find is that the amount of vocal interaction goes down to hell and gone. That's a large number. The number of emails goes up.
Yeah.
Because in the open environment, you don't want to be carrying on conversations all the time because you know you're disturbing others. And so you resort to emails and you copy 20 people in on an email, clogging up their info on the emails and so on. So there are elements here where you do need the people-people interaction and figuring out the best way of making that happen. I like something like one of the new buildings at University of California in LA, UCLA, is that they put a car park that they had down 5 stories and then built about several stories above it. And it was a Getty, the architect, building that did it. And they built 4 towers because there were 4 disciplines moving into this fairly large building.
Right.
But all of the facilities, like getting up to go to the toilet or whatever one is allowed to call it in this country, all of the eating facilities, all of the
bathrooms,
get-together areas, etc. Common areas. So you can go and sit in your office and spend the whole day there if you want to. But if you get up out of it, you're going to come across somebody else.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of thing which to me is smarter. So to come back to your question on how do you get diverse people working together and doing so with the right amount of collaboration? Because you don't want everything to be groupthink and, yeah, we've taken the minutes of the meeting and we'll circulate and are there any corrections to the minutes and, oh, yes, it was actually Fred who blinked at that stage. That sort of nonsense. That's all about earned authority more than line authority.
Mm.
And earned authority is a little bit like the rubber band analogy. If you've got a leader and they're connected by a rubber band to you or me, and they want to lead us in some direction, if they go way off over the horizon, the rubber band snaps because we're just not going to buy it. Conversely, if the rubber band is slack, again, we're not going to move very far. So you've got to have, for this earned authority, the right amount of tension between where people are now and where you would like and hope to move them with their acquiescence. And all I'd say on that is over the years, you learn in the school of hard knocks, some things work better than others.
Yeah.
Never tell anyone they're an idiot, even if you think they are, on account of you might end up working for them 10 years later or vice versa, and they'll remember.
Well, it sounds like from what you've said that number one is key, which is the office environment. So being wary of that point. I think that was made in that book, Deep Work, as well. The fact that, organizations like Apple, they have not moved to open plan workspaces. They have teams that are in offices and then open common areas, where you can get something to eat, go to the bathroom,
yep,
read a book, whatever.
That's the UCLA model. Yep.
Yeah, that UCLA model. And then it seems like as well, to ensure that you're getting people that, or maintaining that the organization knows everything, like that neural network you're talking about, is having vastly open information. So putting as much information out there in a common area, whether it's an internal handbook or, I don't know, a place where people speak about certain topics like a chat-based system or whatever, then that provides enough lag to something like an email or direct chat, where people are messaging each other constantly and interrupting the workflow that happens on the day-to-day.
You're spot on. There's a few things there, one of which is that we tend to overvalue ideas. We tend to say, this is my idea, ergo it follows I'm brilliant for having had it, and I want to develop it and get the benefit from it. Now, I don't have anything against the sort of whole entrepreneurial, let's run with something, let's make it happen, just the opposite, all for that. But there's a thing about ideas themselves that we tend to overvalue them because we only see it from our perspective. But once you start sharing it around, you get other perspectives that either say it's a good or bad or indifferent idea or what have you, or they build on it. That's the key. So when I was chief of a CSIRO division 1 year for the Christmas, they used to break up on Christmas Eve, depending on which day of the week it was, and with a barbecue in the middle of the day, which is very,
of course, that's
social,
classic.
Very classic.
Yeah.
And for a joke, one time I said, okay, to the section leaders, I'd like you guys to enter into the spirit of a little competition that I want to run.
Okay.
You've got two options. You can either come over to Blackwood Hall at Monash University, where I'm going to give a recital of Christmas music on the organ, pretty highbrow stuff, I might add. Or you can take a brown paper envelope, and in that brown paper envelope is going to be an area specified, an area of technology. And your admittance to the barbecue, because I want you to set an example, is either you have written the outline of a provisional patent in that area, or you've come to my concert. Take a pick. And, it's about 50-50. Now, one of the provisional patents that was written was then carried through and was, in fact, quite successful. What my point was is that the idea stage is actually pretty easy.
Yeah.
It's taking ideas and turning them into reality. That's the perspiration. That's the 90%+ of the idea, not the original idea.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people dispute that and find that pretty hard to get on with. And I'd also point out that some people just have a lot more ideas than others. It's something about the left side, right side, how often they flip from one to the other, etc., how diverse their networks are and their experience base, whether they think things through to fundamental and always want to understand things and know the whys. People like that can be a pain because they're forever coming up with new ideas.
Yeah, they can be sort of a wandering idiot in a way. Like they're just...
Yes.
And I have a penchant for doing that. And I've always noticed that in my life that I sometimes am a bit too creative and I like chasing too many ideas. But I found that creating this podcast was a way of containing it and creating some value in a way for others. And you're definitely right. Like ideas... I believe ideas are... Anyone can have ideas, particularly if you go to others and you're chatting to others regularly about those ideas, they become better ideas. But it really is all about execution, I think.
Well, you do have to deliver. You can do a Myers-Briggs type analysis of, what's you introverted, extroverted, what have you. And from that, you can come up with, let me just say very crudely, four broad categories. This is sort of pseudo social psychology. I'm not making any claims around it. There are the off-the-wall types that are really quite extraordinarily innovative and keep coming up with ideas. There's not so many of those around, thank goodness, I might add. Then there's the type who, if they put their mind to it, can be fairly creative and can ask questions and absorb it and analyze it and come up with stuff. And then there's, pick a number. If the first is 5% of the population, the next typical Western, and by the way, there are figures on this, the second category is about 10%. So we're still left now with, 75% or 85. About 40% of the population are, don't push me too far, tell me what you want, give me the resources to do it, and I'll deliver.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, when I've delivered it, I'll go off and I'll do what interests me in life. Thank you very much. because it's actually not delivering stuff for you, mate. Then there's a bunch of people who really, it's the social discourse, and that's the way they're wired. They're just people. Forget it for the moment. I've got to get this job done. Okay, but now I've done it. Let's get back to talking about what we're doing on our next holidays or what we did on the last or what my children are driving me up the wall doing or not, as the case may be. So we're really talking this sort of 5%, 10% of the population, then two big chunks in the round about 40 each. And when you think, well, that's the population that you're working with, that sort of then colours your approach. Don't try and ask the people whose main interest in life is other people and the social side. Don't ask them to be coming up with all the inventive ideas. I mean, I'm not saying they can't have them.
But their interest in life is not going to be in that.
Correct.
And I think you're right. I think the Myers-Briggs really leads itself to the Big Five personality, which is, I think those two are only the really peer-reviewed forms of personality tests that actually work. You know, you've got all sorts of personality tests that I've seen over the years, but the Jungian sort of Big Five archetype, or Big Five, you know, elements of the personality are sort of what, you know, that and the Myers-Briggs are the only really useful thing. And you're totally right. There's some people that are just so extroverted that they don't care. They care more about stories, and that's fine. I think you're right, is understanding your audience in a lot of ways for the ideas and the collaboration that you have in the long
Spot
run
on.
As well.
I mean, you can treat this one as a hypothesis. Some people get very upset if you say, oh, but you're categorising people, you're limiting them and so on. And no, I'm not. I'm just saying a way of interpreting 100 people is that I might expect, taken across the population, is that I might expect this sort of breakdown. But there is hard evidence of the number of ideas it takes to come through to prototypes. This is mainly in the manufacturing industry or anything to do with new products. And it's this classic 1,000 ideas, 100 good ideas, 10 prototypes that you try, 4 that you actually try out in the market, and you know, one of them ends up actually making some money. And this is the so-called universal success curves that starts with a very big number and comes down to one thing in the marketplace works. Now, some people have taken this sort of approach and said, what happens if at each stage of this process, the team that you put on it, and we'll assume these are more than just one person activities, the team that you put on it has either got a whole load of the off-the-wall types, and they're needed early on, or it's just the deliverer types. Give us the resources, tell me what you want, and I'll deliver it, and I've done it before, let's go type thing. And surprise, surprise, you can double the effectiveness of most development systems by mixing and matching the team at each stage of development. Mm. Double the productivity of your outfit. Thank you very much. I'll buy it.
And it makes sense. You don't want too many people just sitting there daydreaming all day.
And you don't want too many people who, after you've done 3 months' work and spent $10 million, coming in and saying, I've got a better idea. this is all wrong. Let's do it again. Let's tear it down.
Yeah, too many of those types are not a good setup at all.
But at the start, that's just what you want.
now, we've cracked well over an hour and 10 minutes now, so I want to jump into some short-fire questions for you that I like to ask most of our guests. What does your morning routine look like?
My morning routine is I always woken up somewhat energized.
Okay.
And as such, mornings are never a problem.
Coffee or tea in the morning?
I like a cup of milk coffee.
Okay.
In the morning, a pseudo latte or a latte in the morning, and a bowl of muesli, and that's it. And that's all I need for the start of the day.
And then you're off.
Depending on where we are, which country we're in, and what the timetable is for the day, if it used to be running, nowadays it's bike riding. If we can fit in a bike ride around the park or a little bit further, generally there's not time for further afield. So that's my mornings.
And what? How often are you at the uni every week?
I'm a half-time appointment.
Yeah.
That tends to be that if I'm in Melbourne, it's most days of the week if I'm not interstate. If I'm out of the country, pretty obviously it's zero time, and the university is pretty generous in allowing this flexibility.
Yeah, and most of your time out of state and international, apart from getting back to Germany to see family and so forth, is it at conferences or something else in particular?
So the interstate time can be all sorts of things. It can be chairing the Australia-India Strategic Research Fund, for example,
That's
a Canberra-based thing. It can be talking with energy companies of one sort and another about developments. It can be talking with a company that's looking at fertilizers that incorporate lignite as an off-farm organic input. So that can be all sorts of topics. Occasionally it's conferences as well.
Mm. Bit of everything, it seems.
Chairing an international congress coming up in Melbourne in a couple of years' time. I opened the World Congress of Ophthalmology.
Really?
And you got to ask, you know, what do I know about that topic? And the answer is not much. It was really all about the topic of research is driven by ever decreasing funding from governments and from research bodies, the availability of it. And there are technical reasons why that's so, but it's a somewhat deep argument. And so researchers, you know, don't like starving, so they go chase the money wherever it is. And an awful lot of it nowadays comes from either pharmaceutical companies or device manufacturing or diagnostic manufacturing companies. So research, which is just targeting public good, which might be, how do you come up with a cheap gizmo for measuring the pressure in your eyes? Because that's what you've got to monitor, to monitor certain diseases. As compared with something really fancy, like let's make a bionic eye, which will attract good funding, or here's a new device that puts a really smart shunt into the eye which allows drainage, etc., and the company that makes the thing is going to make a lot of money out of it. Surprise, surprise, the really cheap gizmo, because there's no company making it and there's not much market for it, and by the way, I'll say no more. So it was addressing that topic that our research is tending to skew away from public good into what can make money sooner rather than later. Mm. And I have no objection in principle to making money. Thank you. You know, we live in that sort of economy. So I'm not running around in a hairy shirt demanding that we have a purely circular economy and that it's all done on barter or anything like that.
No. Yeah, it's an interesting one because you've been very lucky to be involved in both privately and publicly funded research at the CSIRO and Rio. Mm. So I can imagine that's why they would have gotten you in there, to give a unique insight into that in particular. Your evening, how do you decompress at night?
By going to sleep. Essentially, I don't decompress. If I've got a concert on or something I've got to play for, I'll spend a bit of time practicing. Hannah and Laura and I like seeing the odd movie, mm-hmm. And so on. I've slipped in that I should be spending a bit of time learning German rather than speaking pidgin German, which I'm quite good at.
Yeah.
But it really is appalling. So I should be spending more time on that. Reading tends to be confined to planes. I'm out of the country 6+ times a year, sometimes, well, this year at least 6 times. And for the evening, if it's none of the above, including practicing, as I've mentioned, then I'll amuse myself mathematically building neural nets to do astonishing things or something like that.
Just casually.
Yeah.
What's been the best purchase under $200 for you?
I'm not sure because, I mean, the question, what have you purchased that's reasonably cheap that was best? I don't go shopping ever unless I need something.
Yeah.
And then I buy it functionally and I buy it at the quality that's right, that's fit for purpose. And if it's, so if I want a tool, I mean, I've built houses and done furniture making and metalwork and all that sort of stuff. I can do all that. If I want a tool, I just go and buy it, like the doweling jig of making up a sound trap for one of my son's sound recording studio for an air vent. And I needed a better doweling jig than I had. So I just went and bought one. It was under $200.
Yeah, there you go. That's the one, the doweling jig. I've never actually heard of that. Is that like a fitting that goes on the end of a drill or something like that?
The key with doweling two surfaces together, and they've got a hidden dowel in it, is that the hole you drill there has got to be exactly in line with the hole that you drill there. Mm. And there are little jigs that you can get where you put the two pieces flat together and there's a spacer and there's metal sleeves to guide the drill into exactly the spot that it's got to be. You can't do it by eye, or not with my eyes, yeah. Anyway.
if you could have a billboard anywhere in Australia, anywhere at all you want, where would it be, first of all? And then what would you want to put on it? What would it say?
Yeah, I've never thought of that. I mean, I would wonder, I would query whether a billboard was the most effective form of getting a message across now.
I've had someone say that a lot recently.
You would argued perhaps head on to something more in the social media. So you'd probably put a billboard on the freeway near an airport where the traffic is slowed down to a crawl. People are in an unfavourable frame of mind because they're looking at their watches, and if it's Monday morning in Melbourne, it's pathetic trying to get out to Tullamarine.
Yeah. And
so you would put up a message. So that's the place you'd pick because you're guaranteed of audience without distracting them and causing unsafe driving, I might add. So I've picked the region pretty carefully. Now, as to what you would put on it, I think at the moment, I think it needs to be topical. We want to get people off some of the unhelpful debates that we've got in this country, and we talked about some of these earlier, for example, the energy one, onto messages that are actually far simpler, quite practical, and are going to get the job done. So I'd quite happily see a billboard that was topical for the moment rather than a lifetime message around the place. So I'd quite happily say, hey, there actually is a solution for our emissions, and here it is, bang, and just put it up.
Just put a lump of soil.
Yeah.
Like,
believe in soil.
Believe in soil. There you go.
Follow the shoe.
Robin, thank you so much for giving up some time, for coming in, having a chat to us. It's been a real pleasure having you in.
It's been my pleasure.
Cheers.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for making it to the end. Before you run off, subscribe if you enjoyed this episode, or do leave us a rating. For Instagram, go follow us on @uncommon_podcast. for YouTube, search Uncommon Podcast, and don't forget to subscribe if you're watching this video. Also, give us a like or leave a comment on what you thought about the episode. But until next time, thanks so much for listening. This podcast is brought to you by Neural Media. Are you an entrepreneur or marketer who needs help making podcasts, video, or animation? Perhaps you don't have time to manage a freelancer or the budget to deal with an agency. Well, Neural Media can help you with simple and affordable content creation, saving you time and money by taking away the pain of producing that content. To learn more, head to neural.com/media. That's neural.com/media. Play around with our pricing or request a callback directly. Listeners to the show receive a special discount by using the promo code UNCOMMON.